Once again, here we are, the Bingham Boys, myself, John Saltis, and good pal from Bingham Canyon, Ron Yengich. Ron, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, John?
Well, you and I are both kind of voiceless today, so that's probably, is that a good thing for the people out there?
No, I think the people that want to listen to us don't like that, but the people that have prayed for me to be voiceless for years.
Well, that, you know, I'm going to tell you that I've heard that prayer. It's not a short prayer either.
No,
it's not like a rosary kind of thing. One beat on a rosary. No, the whole rosary.
It's the whole thing.
Yeah. So we've got the first time we're going to have a guest on in just a moment, and I'll introduce you in just a second. But, you know, as you have listened to this, you've heard us talk about our roots in Bingham Canyon, which we're going to keep going, of course, and then we also weave into the political, and there's always a lot of politics that we can throw in there, so we're going to do that, and then we're going to come back into the topic that you're going to introduce just shortly. But just as an apology of sorts, we didn't do a lot of Bingham last week. We threatened to talk about the Beehive gas station, the Beeline gas station in Leadmine, and didn't do a lot, and we're not going to go there today. But just as a reminder, we do remember the Beeline and the service station. It was actually kind of a chain of them in Utah, I believe, Beelines.
Yeah.
And then they had one in Leadmine, and Copperton had two service stations, maybe three at one time, but they had two. Adderley Nichols was one, and then T.J. Fat Hurley's Chevron station. But Ron, do you remember those other ones or no?
Yeah, I know. I remember Adderley Nichols. I mean, and we're going to get to that again, if for no other reason than it was owned by a man named Bob Cochran, who was married to my godmother.
Well, there you go.
So we've got to get back to it, yeah.
Okay. So, in the politics, it's like a candy store these days. You know, it's like penny candy, little kid with big eyes open. We see it open the papers in the morning. You know, what is there today? There's Elon versus Trump, the Ukraine drones. Did Biden know that they were going to bomb Ukraine? Some people are reporting that he did, but Trump didn't. Isn't that interesting?
It is fascinating.
You know, Cox, Governor Cox, a no-show on Pride. What's his name? Trevor Lee. You know, he absolutely showed up with his venom, you know, against the gay community. You know, it just goes on and on. Hegseth making his move again to de-wokeify the U.S. Navy.
And don't forget that Joe Biden really is executed in 2020, and then also is a clone of a robot.
That's of course true, because you know it was posted on Truth Social.
I get it.
It's Truth and Social.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? Well, I can't. You can't. I was just thinking, though, like regarding being where we're going, I'll just kind of segue to it a little bit with the mention that I don't remember, maybe other people do, there being a library, a standalone library in Bingham. There were in the schools, but I don't remember a library, an extant library, do you?
I don't think there was. In Highland Boy, the Methodist deaconesses that ran the Highland Boy Community House had a really nice library in the community house, and you could check books out. My sister did a little memoir, my sister Kay, oldest sister, and she mentions that in there, that they had classics and they had other books that were relevant that kids could check out. I don't remember.
Well, Ron, why don't you go ahead and introduce your granddaughter?
All right, I will. So we're introduce my granddaughter, Gabrielle Nelson, my eldest grandchild and my eldest granddaughter. To me, she is Holmes and I am Watson. I introduced her to Sherlock Holmes when she was, I don't know, five or six or seven. And she immediately decided that she got to be Holmes and I was Watson. And it's remained that way forever. Gabrielle is now living in New Mexico, graduate of College of Idaho. Creative writing was her major. She has had poetry published. She's been an actress, done a number of things on stage. She also is a horsewoman, doesn't like to be called a cowgirl, who is very knowledgeable about horses and has had a number of jobs, working now in New Mexico. She can tell us a little bit about that, but also has worked in Illinois and other places in that industry, and extremely well-read. And when we decided we were going to talk about banned books in Utah, particularly when I read the most recent list of banned books, a lot of them I didn't know at all. So I called her and said, "Do you know these?" And she knows a lot of them, and knows about them because she's read them. And so the sense was that we have somebody that knows these books that have now been banned in the state of Utah to talk a little bit about them. So welcome, Gabrielle.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Gabrielle, did you read these books as a course of your studies or later on because you were curious?
No, most of these books I read because they are unbelievably popular with young adults. I did notice that Utah has made a point to ban a lot of books by Canadian authors. So I wonder if they don't have just a little bit of spite against Canada, because Margaret Atwood's on there. Ruby Carr is on there. And then the author of Water for Elephants is also Canadian. But no, these are books that I stumbled across because they were accessible in my libraries. And also, they're incredibly popular books.
So tell us a little bit about, is there, with these books, we're going to talk about a couple specifically, maybe two or three. Is there a common denominator that you found in these books to indicate why you believe that they were banned?
So most of these books, I believed, have been banned for intimate and sexual content. And so there have been scenes or moments that have made people uncomfortable, and they have used that to justify banning the books and not looking at a part and not looking at the whole.
Okay. Historically, I mean, and you and John as well, and I think myself to a degree, like literature, love to read, love books. When you see that something is banned for a specific portion of it, does that alone trouble you?
Very much, because it's ignoring the bigger picture that comes around a lot of these books. The intimacy and sexual scenes in some of these books is related to confronting sexual assault and confronting sexual abuse. It also has a lot to do with consent. And there is no safer place to encounter these things than in the pages of a book, because it's not actually happening to you in that moment. You are learning about the possibility of something that could have happened to someone else, could have happened to yourself, and I think it opens up a dialogue. So it is very frustrating to me when I see government and institutions shutting the doors on books that really, their purpose is to open the door to dialogues about these other really important things that young adults and kids need to be aware of and need to have an outlet to learn about and then also confront.
Among the books that you've got in hand or you've read in the Utah banned books, is there one that stands out as like, boy, they've made a big mistake here? This is a beautifully well-written book or a beautiful story or something to learn from.
Orcs and Crake by Margaret Atwood is a stunning book where she did a lot of research on scientific happenings and then use those to build a post-apocalyptic world and what that could possibly look like. It was very well researched and is just a brilliant and unique take on, you know, what happens when government fails. I am shocked that that book is banned. Another one, Milk and Honey by Ruby Carr. It is a book of poetry. She has sold over 3 million copies. I believe it has outsold The Odyssey. That book is on the banned book list, and that one is just shocking to me.
Can you tell us what's the methodology? It's not, are they always banned statewide or district by district or, school when we talk about a book banning?
I think there was something that I saw that's called like the H-29 or the H-26, and it's a statewide ban they're aiming for, if I understood correctly.
Yeah, I think that what happens is if they're banned in a particular number of school districts in Utah, then they can be banned throughout the state. Yeah. So when you're talking about these particular authors, are there more, as you've seen the recent ban, are there more women authors that are banned than men, or?
Yes, there are more women authors who have been banned. And I think for the most part, most of the content is related to specifically the point of view of intimacy and sex of women.
Okay.
Those are targets, I will say.
Are you planning to read a passage of any kind in these books today? I saw you holding your finger in the middle of that we're looking at, Gabrielle.
I would love to read a couple of poems
from
Rupi Kaur. They're short, they're very digestible. She does illustrations to go with them. Again, this is such a brilliant gateway for young people to become interested in poetry and to find relatable experiences. I'm just shocked that this book is on that list.
So, and you're reading from Milk and Honey?
Yes.
Okay.
And before I read that, just something else that I would say that is a relief is she became popular on Instagram, specifically during COVID. So even if people are banning the physical copy of the book, she can be found on Instagram. She can be found reading her poetry on YouTube. In this case, with this particular book, I think a ban is almost, it's something that can be thwarted because this book is available in so much more than just this physical copy.
Right. I was wondering, I mean, we're banning a handful of books in a handful of school districts. And yet the internet is full of easily accessed anytime 24/7 pornography.
Yes.
No, we've talked about that a little bit. I mean, the foolishness of the ban in this day and age is twofold, I think. The foolishness, not the fraud and wrongfulness in it. And that is because of the internet and because of access to the internet, all of these books likely could be found if somebody wanted them. They can't go to their school library and look at them. That means that some people that might want to read these books, they're going to be unavailable to them there. But the idea that it's going to ban them from people actually getting to them is foolishness. And again, in my judgment, stupidity. But the idea that you ban it then goes out to people to tell them, a certain group, that people who read this book or this kind of book are bad people. We don't want that. And the second thing is, from the author's perspective, it may cause a boost in sales
the opposite. It's like when you told, you know, don't drink beer, you know, and then you sneak your dad's beer. You find it. I mean,
I never did that.
I know you didn't. But all of your friends did.
One of them.
I know.
Everyone.
And then they went home and blamed the Yankich family for letting the kids into the fridge. I know.
Troublesome thing was I always got blamed for it somehow.
Of course. I'll tell you another time about a mission farewell I went to, and the send-off was like, all my friends made me do it.
Yeah, exactly.
We go, wait a minute, you were the drug dealer.
Yeah, right.
What are you talking about?
Let's not go to the 60s. So
it wasn't that long ago. It was the 70s.
Read to us, give us an intro a little bit, and read to us some passages from Milk and Honey.
Sure. So the illustration for this poem is a glass like that you would drink out of, and it is full of waves. And it is called I Am Water, soft enough to offer life, tough enough to drown it away.
That's it?
That's the entire poem.
Well, I can see why they banned that.
Yeah. Well,
what?
When you and I have talked about this.
Yes.
Because we do poetry competitions. I should say this about us.
We do.
We will pick a stupid subject and say, all right, you write a poem and I'll write a poem and we'll see who does the best one. The best one we did was, I think it's called 87 Miles to Ogden or something.
Mm-hmm.
On the way back from Boise to Salt Lake, there's a sign, 87 miles to Ogden or something. Okay, so we're going to do that poem. And the poems we wrote surprisingly hit the same topic, but they're totally different. So when you read that poem as a young woman, as opposed to the three old men in this room, when you read that poem, what does it mean to you? What does it conjure up to you?
Well, what I love about this poem is the cleverness of it. In so few sentences, you know, she's offering that you can be something that gives life, but you can also be something that takes it away. And that is kind of a reoccurring theme in her poetry. Like, for example, this poem has no title, but it is an illustration of it's the outline of a woman with a baby in her stomach. And it is, when my mother was pregnant with her second child, I was 4. I pointed at her swollen belly, confused at how my mother had gotten so big in such little time. My father scooped me in his tree trunk arms and said, "The closest thing to God on this earth is a woman's body. It's where life comes from. And to have a grown man tell me something so powerful at such a young age changed me to see the entire universe rested at my mother's feet."
That's like, okay, like, isn't that what they called in a war, like burning the village down to save it or something? When you ban a book, yeah. I mean, there's one or two lines or passages, maybe even an entire poem that somebody is bothered by, and yet all the other pages of that book are filled with beauty. It makes no sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense, except in this sense to people, some people's sense, not mine. And that is that we're talking about things that these kids shouldn't be talking about or seeing. But we know, again, from our own experiences in life, that somebody's going to talk to us about them. It may be Bob, the older teenager down the street, or it may be somebody that you overhear. But in this day and age, it's on everybody's phone. And to listen or read that poem, series of poems that discuss this, even maybe things that are a little bit more in the minds of some people risque, this puts it all into context, where a 7-minute video clip from your phone doesn't. And that's where we missed the boat on this stuff, I think.
Prior to knowing what you would be talking about, I just researched like the top 10 most banned books and believe, and just any list from Google. I wasn't being like definitive. That didn't matter to me. But the top 10, I don't need to go through them all, but it starts with Catcher in the Rye. And, you know, and I could name names of some of these that are Grapes of Wrath, To Kill a Mockingbird. And about, and as you were saying this, 40 or 50% of them were written by women.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Gabrielle, I don't know which of these authors are Canadian. but uniformly, I think, I'm just counting, I wrote it down, 6 or 7 were banned due to sexual content. The other ones were racial something, something.
Right.
And there was one, believe it or not, let me see which one it is, The Color Purple, which was not racist, but was basically saying that white people weren't heroes. And for that reason, it was banned, according to this list. And right. I'm not saying one or the other, but it's pretty obvious what people are afraid of. They're afraid of talking about the human body and intimacy, interaction between the two sexes. It bothers some people to the point of what we're seeing, beyond distraction. This is not good, because these are beautifully, beautiful books.
Well, I mean, the other thing that bothers people is they don't understand it, so they're afraid of it. And they're, I mean, To Kill a Mockingbird, there's a discussion of, it's right. A rape trial. I mean, and for me as a criminal defense lawyer, it's one of the stepping stones that led me to go to law school and be a criminal defense lawyer. There's nothing purient about it, but there is something about defending somebody that's innocent and making a false claim of being abused. Those are things that we can understand, even put in the context of sexual aggression. There's something in there for everybody to learn once you're of the age that you're going to read that book. And so with Gabrielle reading some of these poems and is going to talk some more about some of these books, what we're saying also is that your vision or version of what life is about is not something we accept. We don't buy into that. And that's the type of exclusion that we disagree with fundamentally in this country. Everybody has a voice. Anyway, that's my take.
So a good poem, and then I can stop going to so much of this poetry, but I think this is just a good segue to talk about how this affects people's access to books when you ban books because their topics make you uncomfortable. This poem is, "Our backs tell stories, no books have the spine to carry, women of color." And Rupi was born in India. She's a woman of color. And if you start banning books exclusively because they have moments of content that make you uncomfortable as someone who is not from that background, it gets rid of a lot of narratives that can save a person's life, that can give them someone to relate to. Toni Morris is banned often, and she grapples with some hard topics. Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, sure. The House on Mango Street. These are books by women of color that deal with sexual abuse in part. And that is not the whole story, but that is part of their story. And I feel like for some people, it is an opportunity to understand when that happens to somebody else. But I think it also gives agency to people to talk about when it has happened to them.
How would you teach a book, one of these books, in school? Would you try to teach it, first of all? They have been banned, but so now the red flag is out on them. But given the opportunity, how would you teach a class of young adults about any of the books that are in front of you?
I would encourage them to read and say, you are going to have questions. You might have moments that make you uncomfortable. When you encounter those moments, come to me. Come to your parent. Let's talk about why.
Okay, because I want to tell you an example. When I was in high school, by the way, on this top 10 list, there is a book by Toni Morrison, Beloved is number 2.
Yep.
And I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings is about number 8.
Yep.
Shout out to the Greeks. Maya Angelou was married to a Greek guy. That's her last name. They divorced, but, you know.
Well, we can't hold that against her.
We can't hold that. It's probably a great move on her part. So in high school, senior in high school, I had a literature class of some kind. I don't know what it was. And you know, you could pick whatever book you could study for at least among the books. Our teacher let us choose a book, and her name was Jean Woolen. She's one of my favorite teachers of all time at Bingham High School. She was marginally older than the students. But I had been given a book called Man-Child in the Promised Land by Claude Brown, by a good friend of mine who lived in Copperton. His name was Kent Peterson. He had read the book. His family, LDS family, great bunch of people. Jim Peterson was a principal and stuff in the schools, the whole families in education, everything. But he introduced me to the book, and I read it. And, you know, me being me, I thought, well, if we're going to read a book, let's read one I've already read. It'll make it easy on me.
Sure.
So Gene Woolham said, well, you know, this is maybe, maybe not, because the book is, of the themes that were on that list of top 10 books, sexual content and racism, Man-Child in the Promised Land has both of those in great numbers. So what she did is she had the students take the book to their parents or some kind of note to their parents and said, we are going to study this book this quarter, whatever it was, and with your permission, and we will not read pages like 86 to 94, and we will not read page whatever. Of course they were there. But the parents let everybody read it. So we did read it. And that was at least a way around it. And you know what, of course, happened. Everybody read the pages anyway. It just wasn't part of the discourse in class.
Right.
So I always thought that was at least, you know, an opening for people to say there are ways to become educated without banning and without stopping, without burning. This guy, you know, he was always on the late talk shows in the 70s and 80s, 60s, 70s, 80s. He was a very prominent man and really moved the needle,
yeah,
on racial injustice and so on. And he grew up in Harlem. It's all about that. And gang violence, all kinds of stuff. Great book. But we got to read that in high school. I don't think that would be at all possible today.
Oh, the autobiography of Malcolm X, I'm sure it can't be read places. Black Like Me, Dick Gregory's book, which is the N-word, probably couldn't be read either. And I want to bring this up. Gabs and I argued a little bit about this the other night when we were talking on the phone. We argue a lot.
In the best way.
In the best way. But, you know, we have to be careful about banning other books too. And one of the things that has happened considerably in some areas of the country is banning books, or at least not teaching them anymore, because they're Eurocentric. You know, a lot. Some of my favorite books, and she knows this, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Aeneid, Gilgamesh epic, are not taught anymore a lot. I would confronted each of those in high school, and it was great that I did. But there's this sense that we can't teach that anymore because they're Eurocentric, and that's bad. And I equally think that it isn't as bad as actually having a statute that bans books. But I do believe that it's problematic when we say these historical classics shouldn't be taught anymore. Shakespeare shouldn't be taught anymore because, after all, he's a white guy from England. And so I think we got to be careful not just to criticize their side, the other side, But to be careful what we do as well. Huck Finn. Huck Finn's problematic a lot of places. And it shouldn't be, because we're talking in a lot of these instances. These books are going to be critical to the odyssey of people in this century. Those books were critical as well about the odysseys of people at that time. And so that's a point that I want to make. Do you want to respond, granddaughter? Mm-hmm.
There are so many books with modern narratives that I think are relatable and accessible, where you can get kids involved because the authors are alive. They can look them up. They can find Q&As. They can even reach out to the authors. And I think that can make such a difference in making a book come to life. Eleanor and Park is a book that has been banned by Rainbow Rowell. It is brilliant. It deals with verbal abuse, and it deals with young people figuring out themselves in ways that I would argue are very PG. There's a young boy in it who experiments with wearing eyeliner, not because he has any questions about his sexuality, but because he sees all the rock stars wear it.
Sure.
And he wants to be like a rock star. And it's a brilliant book that has been banned. Sing, Unburied, Sing. It deals with racism, and racism within families is another book that I feel would be brilliant to bring into a curriculum, and just to allow for different perspectives, but to also just expand knowledge and to kind of update a curriculum.
Okay.
If we're going to go that route, I've got modern literature that I feel we need a place for both.
Okay, thank you, because I didn't bring my copy of Felix Dennis's poem, which is a great poem called Dead White Men, okay? So we won't go there. But I do think, I appreciate the fact that we could talk about that in the manner that we have.
Well, and the biggest thing is, you know, we've come to this road of absolutes for some reason. It feels like politically, just altogether, it's all or nothing. It's
right.
You know, it's very sterile, and it's not even allowing for duality to exist or anything bigger than that. And that is something that makes me nervous when it comes to banning books. I don't think banning books actually works in this modern age with the access to internet and social media and YouTube, and just how accessible these books are through other means than just a physical copy. But what I don't like is how it is pushing us into an absolute of, right, we're going to draw these hard lines and just sterilize everything. It's very much like The Giver, another banned book.
I mean, well stated. I think that that's something that the three of us agree on, and we hope that give the people that listen to this some food for thought. I do think that the one thing about banning anything, it's like loyalty oaths and other things like that. When you say, tell anybody they have to believe something, I believe that is as anti-American as we can be. I think that that is why people around the world have loved America, because we've been the country to stand up against that type of attitude. And that's what we were brought up to believe in Bingham Canyon by the people that we knew. It was an idea that you embrace the stuff that you see in other people, and that you embrace their cultures and their attitudes.
Well, we learned not to avoid those people, but to learn from those people.
Right.
So, yeah, I saw all kinds of stuff as a young kid, you know, that today's young kids don't see. And we don't need to go in the weeds about it, but it was a different environment every bit of Utah was different in Bingham.
Right.
And I'm not trying to lionize it again, but that's easy to do. It was simply, you weren't going to be lectured to because you could see it with your own eyes, as Gabrielle said. You could find it somewhere else.
Right.
So you can tell me, don't drink, but I lived above a bar. So it's kind of hard to kind of, you know, mix those two things, you know, because I could see great fun down there and I saw tragedy and all that kind of stuff. But you learn. And without the opportunity to learn, you might as well just give it up because somebody else thinks they can learn for you. And those people, the ones that are banning the books or being the jerks and all that kind of stuff, they don't have any insights more depth than the cat that's sitting behind Gabrielle right now.
Well, that's my grandcat. He's a pretty smart cat.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, the thing, one of the things that troubles me is this. And I'll make a little bit of a confession here. When we stop people from expanding who they are and what they're knowledgeable about or how other people look at stuff, then we limit their human growth and development. And I've written down Allen Ginsberg here. And I remember Howl, and I remember reading it. I think I was a senior in high school. And there were some really uncomfortable parts of that. I didn't talk with teacher about it or anything. I can't even remember why I read it or who gave it to me. Probably my older brother. But I mean, it troubled me in the sense that as I read it, I go, ooh. But it was an eye opener to me that there were people that weren't Doris Day and Rock Hudson who happened to be gay on those old comedies that we watched at the youth theater. And yet somewhere that stuck with me as we began to understand the oppression of gay people in this country. And also opened me up to Jack Kerouac, who I like a lot, and some of the other beat poets. And I brought Kerouac's Poems for All Sizes today that I read occasionally, which is great. And so it also inhibits us from being challenged in a book to grow ourselves. Milk and Honey, you've talked about that. What's the one? I'm going to screw this
Water up. For Elephants.
Water for Elephants. Tell us about Water for Elephants.
Water for Elephants, I imagined, is banned for sensual content. But it's really quite a clever story where you are led to believe in the beginning of the book that a woman has decided to murder her husband, and you don't know why. Really, it's a story of people who are forgotten. It's a story of animal cruelty and getting your comeuppance for that, and about being understanding of people with different backgrounds. So, yes, there is a woman who has a relationship with a man who is not her husband in that book. But so other than
any
that...
Any sitcom on TV now?
Honestly, the media that we will... not limit accessibility to versus the books that we will go after is just unbelievable. So yes, that book was a really surprising ban for me. I really had to think about why on earth someone would take offense to that book. And I'm curious why people aren't more up in arms about having this be something that becomes, it's gone from being an individual's choice to being a entire district and state government's choice. And why family has not been brought into consideration. Like you were mentioning earlier about getting a permission slip signed by parents to allow a book to be read. I don't know why that wasn't an option first or even considered to allow families to make the decision about what their children have access to.
Well, you know, Utah is the land of irony. So the people who don't want big government and vocalize for family values and encourage all of us to celebrate our individual freedoms are the ones that are taking them away.
But yes. that's historically the case.
Well, then we got to learn from history.
Yeah, we do. And censors are always the ones that it's not a plebiscite. You don't vote on what the censor does. It is the group in power that makes those decisions. And we've talked about this. That's one of the reasons that, speaking of literature, it's extremely important and remains important in my life. History is important too. These are a few people that are voting on these things in school districts. They're not taking a poll of everybody in the community. There's not a secret ballot of people to do it. And so we have a small amount of people that are banning these books and not talking about them with someone who has even read them, which we've tried to do tonight.
Right, right.
So you want a last word, granddaughter?
I'm always happy to kick us out with a poem.
All right.
I'll end with this one.
Who's it by?
By Rupi Kaur. Okay. It's the book I have next to me. It is, I want to apologize to all the women I have called pretty. Before I've called them intelligent or brave, I'm sorry I made it sound as though something as simple as what you're born with is the most you have to be proud of when your spirit has crushed mountains. From now on, I will say things like, you are resilient or you are extraordinary. Not because I don't think you're pretty, but because you are so much more than that.
Very nice.
Great way to end it. You make my heart soar like a hawk.
Love you, Grandpa.
Love you too, honey.
Nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet
Are we going to move on here? I'll give you one other one that,
sure.
And we'll talk to the next topic. I think it's a segue to it. When I was young and you were younger.
I'm older than you.
I know. So a book that was banned then, about 1972, was Catch 22.
Sure.
And it was profane. And there was sexual content, and there was swearing, and there was people getting chopped in half by propeller blades. It was very graphic. But it was a war novel, and that's the way that they spoke. And Joseph Heller wrote what I consider to be one of the greatest epic modern, certainly modern novels of all time, Catch 22.
Sure.
So it was banned, though. And it was banned for 4 years in different counties, not dissimilar, but people fought back. It was in unbanned. So were two Kurt Vonnegut books about the same time. I find that unfathomable. You'd ban these guys, you know? But here's a quote, if you don't mind, from Joseph Heller's Catch 22 that can bring us into the next topic.
Great. It
goes like this. It was miraculous. It was almost no trick at all, he saw, to turn vice into virtue and slander into truth, impotence into abstinence, arrogance into humility, plunder into philanthropy, thievery into honor, blasphemy into wisdom, brutality into patriotism, and sadism into justice. Anybody could do it. It required no brains at all. It merely required no character.
There you go.
Who is that? Who does that describe today?
Well, it describes exactly who we know. It describes our president and a lot of other people. And we want to be careful not to become those people in our own way. The thing about that book and that movie is that those were times when we weren't fighting. That was part of the Great War. But this was a reaction, as Kerouac's book was, on the road, to what America thought they were, but there were also the dark sides to them. We got to know them. We got to understand that even in greatness, there's problems. And you don't get to just be great or have the greatest beautiful bill in the world without understanding the secondary consequence. And that's what that book is about.
Yeah, it is.
And that quote is about.
Yeah. So anyway, that was, again, one of the arc books for me. It changed me in a lot of ways to read Catch 22 and not be able to put it down and read it again.
Yeah.
You know, he only wrote, I think, two books, maybe three. But I really loved that book. It was, and I read an interview by him one time. It was in probably Playboy, because that's who did the great interviews. And the question was something like, well, why'd you set it in wherever it was, an air base? And he said, it could have been set anywhere. This isn't a story about war.
No.
It's a story about people.
People, yeah.
And how people in power suppress and keep some people down or don't tell them the truth or change the rules because they can. And that's kind of what Catch-22 is happening in there too. He could never get away.
Right.
He could never get away. Yossarian ultimately said, I'd rather live on my feet than die on my knees. And Yossarian goes, no, I'd rather live on my knees than die on my feet. You know, and he just sails away into the...
Well, and the beauty of that book comes out after... the Vietnam War started, and before we knew about the lies that led America, we knew totally the lies that led us to going full in Vietnam while friends of ours were being killed there. And so those books are critical for us to understand human nature and to prevent stuff like that from happening.
Well, the upside of reading Catch-22 by any population far outweighs the short ban it had. But nonetheless, because it was banned at all, is not a very good omen for anything literate. You know, it just isn't. We don't have an opportunity to grow as a society if we throw away the parts of it that are uncomfortable.
Now, as someone who worked on loading docks in the mine at Kennecott for a work crew down south building buildings, if anybody thinks that four-letter words aren't used routinely in the world, and I know that's not the case now, the kind of language is in Catch-22 is nothing to what we hear every day. No way. And it doesn't say that we should or that there's not a better way to express yourself, but it happens and you move on.
There we go.
Gabs, thank you again for coming, and maybe we can have you on again.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'll come talk about books and small towns anytime.
Okay.
Take this with you, Gabs. Here's Oscar Wilde, a gay man, who said, books that the world calls immoral are the books that show the world its own shame.
Yeah.
So.
And who, by the way, came to Utah, Oscar Wilde did, was at the Salt Lake Theater, which is now a building. It's been torn down. And guess who went and saw Oscar Wilde?
You did.
No.
No?
This is long before my time.
I don't know.
Brigham Young.
Oh, really?
Brigham Young actually went to the audience with Oscar Wilde when he was here.
And they drank Madame Paterini gin.
No, he left early.
Oh. Five Wives Vodka?
No. So that was cheap. Your Mormon side of the family is not going to like that.
Well.
All right. I love you, Gabs. Take care. Be safe, huh?
Love you, too.
Bye-bye.
Well, I don't know how much time we got here. Bill, can you kind of give us all right. So why don't we just do what we do and talk about Binger for a second? And I already kind of, we don't have a lot of time to talk over everything Trump, unless you got one thing that, you got the one Trump thing that you want to go in at, just
no.
Because it's there. Like I said, it's the candy store. What do you, the trouble is, he's a candy store, or he's the cereal aisle in Harmon's. There's all these cereals there, but you always go to the sweet one or the chocolatey one, and he's at every freaking day. You can't say no. He's just in front of us.
We're in the Southwest. You can go to the Mexican food aisle because he's now called Taco.
Oh, he's Trump. Yeah, I forgot about that.
I guess we can go there.
Yeah, there you go.
That's not going over.
He doesn't like that.
No. You know, but for somebody who likes to give people nicknames and likes to call people names.
Pocahontas.
And likes to tell.
Little Rubio.
Little Marco. And
Sleepy Joe.
And he and Elon Musk are now exchanging problems. The thing about it is that, and this troubles me, is that political dialogue now is based on ad hominem attacks, Latin phrase, to the man, not to the issue. It's to the man. Donald Trump has taken that to an art form, and that's troubling. And he hates it when people go back at him with it, and he fights back at it, as do his supporters. Again, got to be careful about that. It's the old deal in baseball. If you're going to, you can throw all the raspberries you want, but you can cross a line. But the problem is, then you've got to come up to the plate, and I'm not going to be throwing a raspberry. I'm going to be throwing a horsehide ball at you. Donald Trump doesn't have that done to him enough. And so this is one.
Well, that's what we said. In Bingham, he'd been slapped a little bit way before he had the opportunity to flunk out of Wharton and claim he had a 4.0.
And he would have also had to defend himself. And if he did that on a sports diamond, he would have too. Which isn't to say that we should hurt one another, but it is to say, if that's where you want to go, then start wearing that type of thing. And he's wearing this one a lot.
He hasn't been able to come out of that. Somebody, whoever, and the thing of it is it wasn't the Democrats that did this.
No.
It wasn't the woke movement that did this. It wasn't the clever Ron or Sleepy John. It was the Wall Street Journal that gave him that name. Wall Street Journal, conservatives, they come, right. You know, supporter of Republican governments from who knows how long back, and conservative fiscal policies, everything said, Trump always chickens out. Taco.
Right.
That wasn't
on tariffs.
Me.
Yeah. No, it's on not. I mean, it's great.
Well, it's not just tariffs any longer. It's on just about everything.
On everything.
Right?
But that was where it started. I wanted to do a parody when he ran first. I wanted to have a band, and the parody would be, you know, the song Guantanamera.
Oh, no.
You know?
You're going to sing, aren't you?
No, I'm not going to sing. But because I would if I didn't have my voice was this way. I wanted to, and I wrote the lyrics to One Ton of Merda.
What?
One ton of merda.
Merda.
One ton of shit.
Oh.
Okay? And that is what his policies were. Okay? So people have thought about this stuff a lot. But whoever did the taco thing, and there are a lot of, on YouTube and other places, Instagram, people that have done songs about it, it's hilarious, and he deserves it, because he's got to wear what he does to other people.
Well, he did it to every political opponent. There were 17 guys on the stage, or women, I believe, in 2016 when he was running, and he had a nickname for every one of them, and every one of them ultimately fell, you know?
Yeah.
And some people think that's cute to call, you know, Senator Warren Pocahontas. I don't think it's particularly cute, but he doesn't. He thinks it's funny. And I guess, or his followers think there's some kind of cleverness to it. But you know what? I hearken back to, 23,000 years ago, and Pericles speaking.
Right.
You know, the great funeral oration that he gave. It didn't mock anyone. It was a very empathetic speech. But he has none of that in him. So, you know, but his go-to has always been to smack down somebody else uneloquently.
And make fun of him.
And I've said it 1,000 times. You have. Like, can't you see that this is not character? If character matters, this is not the path.
No. And the point of it is we're laughing about that. If somebody had started with that without him being the man he is, then you go, no, I don't want, don't argue my side of the political aisle with that. But if that's who you are, then you have to eat it. And that's where the deal is. By the way, speaking about people that are good people that have never done this kind of thing, we want to bring up tonight a family, the Sotirio family.
Sure.
Tomorrow, I'm going to go to my dermatologist, who is the son of one of the Sotirio brothers, who are from Copperton.
Copperfield.
And good Greek folks.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They owned a pharmacy down here in Salt Lake City. Tommy and Gus and their sister.
And Leo.
And Leo, who was my dermatologist. Now his son is my dermatologist. And I'm going to go see them, and I'm going to go to his son. To me, he's a son. I know he's got a name, but he's Dr. Sotirio, too. Anyway, because he's going to check to see whether I've got
Leo's
stuff.
Alicia is a Sotirio. She's just got married this past weekend.
Just great people. Yeah. And Gus's son was a pharmacist and is now a lawyer and married to a judge and a great kid, too.
Yeah, if you've ever been, it's not really the deli that it once was and stuff, but it had Broadway Pharmacy, then Broadway Deli, and Broadway Apartments. Is it Second South?
It's on Broadway. I think it's on Third.
Third, okay. I can picture it. I've been there a zillion times, and people used to often buy their Greek lambs there for Easter. Yeah. So there were, I think, four. There may have been more of them, but there were three brothers and a sister. They grew up, they were Copperfield. They lived in Greek town. And I know this because I'd asked my father about it long ago, and my Aunt Mary. They were neighbors of ours, of theirs, way back in the 20s and 30s, the Sotirio family. And when they moved out, I don't know when they did, but when they did, they began their entry into American capitalism and the American, building their own society, building a better thing for their family through their farm. And they did what you see today, and whether it be a work crew of lawn people or a bunch of people in a fast food restaurant or their family members. So their family built.
Right. I mean, they moved Broadway down here and they built the pharmacy, but it started out as a grocery store.
Right. That's what they did. They worked as a family.
Just the best people in the world. I used to love to go in there. That's where, to use my mother's term, my wife, after we got married and we moved into the city where the house is now, that's where we went. We shopped there, but they were our pharmacists.
Yeah.
Old fashioned in the sense that they knew their customers, they trusted their customers, they were fair and good and decent people and funny people, and it was a great place to go. So I'm keeping my tradition. I remember telling my mother I was going there. She goes, "Oh, I know the Sotirios. We know them." And then she got into other Greek families that she knew. But good Bingham people, successful family, and family that stayed together, worked hard together, and made something that their family and those of us from Bingham can be proud of.
No, it's a seriously good legacy downtown. It's an old legacy downtown Salt Lake. Not everyone knows. I mean, given the name Broadway, as opposed to calling it Odysseus Deli,
right?
It's Broadway Deli. So, you know, people don't get it that it's a Greek-owned Greek market or deli or pharmacy. All that Broadway used like four times. So, you know, it also is not a theater. but
it's not painted blue and white.
No, and then there are no columns. These guys were a good family. I knew all of them. And, they passed over time, most of them. I think Leo's still living.
Leo's still living.
And just, again, great people.
Now,
hats off to them.
Shout out to them tonight.
Okay, that's it for Bingham Boys. We got Bingaman this time.
We did.
You know, so that's good.
Well, you're too hard on yourself. I mean, we didn't finish hard with the Beeline gas station, but we'll go back to it again. John, for those of you listening, John's been troubled by this ever since we ended the last.
It's been a week. He's
been troubled by it. We'll go back. We'll talk about the Cochran family. We'll talk about the Massa family again.
Sure.
Got to anyway, because it's my godmother.
Well, when we get through with your relatives, we'll start on.
Okay, that's okay, good. I think that's a good idea.
All right, Ron, we'll see you next week. I'm going out of town for a week, but I'll be back next Tuesday.
Right, I'll
fly into out of town, New York, and we'll see you next
all
time.
All right, you too, Johnny. Be safe.
You too. Thank you.
Peace and love, everyone.